Otherwise Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, it's Wednesday, which means that it is time for our weekly wrap. It's that one day of the week when you, the listener, have an opportunity to help direct and produce the show. I'm excited because we haven't had the weekly wrap since we started this new format. Ever since we moved from 3 to 5 to 2 to 4, we haven't been able to do the weekly wrap. We had to wait until everyone joined us in the 2 to 4 time before we were able to get back up and running. So I am so excited that today we can roll out our 2 to 4 weekly wrap, which means you call today and you can put anything you want on the table. The show belongs to you. It also gives Justina and I an opportunity to talk about some of the issues that may not be enough to sustain an entire show, but it's worth like a smidgen. It's worth a look at. One interesting thing we're going to have on tap today is at 3 p.m., we're going to be joined by Dean Emeritus Dwayne Wickham to talk about Haiti. He had, in his former life, before he was our founding dean, he was a reporter, and he wrote tons of stories about Haiti. And so he has a new piece that just came out in USA Today, and so we're going to have him on at 3 p.m., but the phone lines are going to be open. 410-319-8888. And I love that this has fallen, the revisit, the reintroduction, that reinvigorating moment where we're bringing back the weekly wrap also falls squarely on the birthday of one of my sheroes, Sister Auntie Fannie Lou Hamer, who in so many ways was the epitome of what it looked like to struggle in this country, what the true cost of struggle is for a Black woman, the damage that was done to her body without her permission by doctors, the way she worked and slaved in the field as a sharecropper, the demanding that she did that her whole team be seated at the Democratic National Convention, that she said that she was just tired, sick and tired, as we all know, of being sick and tired. Fannie Lou Hamer was the one who believed and argued nobody is free until everybody's free. Now, you've probably heard iterations off of that quote before. There's one that we use. This is nobody's free until Black women are free. I've heard that. Nobody's free until Black folks are free. I've heard that. Nobody's free until children are free. Heard that. But it started back with Fannie Lou Hamer, who made the statement that I wholeheartedly agree with. Nobody, not one person, not a man, woman, child, not a person of any gender, not a person who's Black or white, not a Latinx person, not an Indigenous person, not an Asian American person, not one person on this planet, in this country, in this state, in this city, not one person is free until everybody is free. Fannie Lou Hamer was an American voting and women's rights activist, a community organizer, and a leader in the civil rights movement. She was the co-founder and vice chair of the Freedom Democratic Party, which she represented at the 1964 Democratic National Convention. Fannie Lou Hamer also organized Mississippi's Freedom Summer along with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. She was also a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, an organization created to recruit, train, and support women of all races who wish to seek election into government office. She began her civil rights activism in 1962, and she continued until her health declined 9 years later. She was known for her use of spiritual hymnals and quotes and her resilience in leading the civil rights movement for Black women in Mississippi. There are two new books out about Fannie Lou Hamer. We had Kate Clifford Lawson on the show along with John Wesley. That's one book that's out. There's a second book that just dropped today by Keisha Blaine, which is all about Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer helped and encouraged thousands of African Americans in Mississippi to become registered voters. She helped hundreds of disenfranchised people in her area through her work in programs like the Freedom Farm Cooperative. She unsuccessfully ran for the Senate 1964 and for the Mississippi State Senate in 1971. She died March 14, 1977, at the age of 59. She died young. Her eulogy was delivered by U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Andrew Young, and she was posthumously inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in 1993. Fannie Lou's birthday. I believe that we have a clip of Fannie Lou Hamer, Dre. We're going to pull that up in just a second so you can hear Fannie Lou Hamer in her own words. What does that mean to you? Nobody is free until everybody is free. That means that our freedom is intrinsically tied to the person that is sitting next to us, standing next to us, surviving alongside of us. Our freedoms are corrected. And in order to be free, there are things we have to give up, even in a free society. When I was teaching my class today, a student talked about what it meant to be free and the fact that the government should not be able to control what we do. So if the government, for example, were to regulate the World Wide Web, what if they decided, you know, we're going to start turning the World Wide Web off, that at 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night, we are shutting it down until the next morning in order to help us, to break our addiction, to keep children off the internet, that a student said, you know what, you can't do that. You're taking away our freedom. And I argue your freedom is tied to my freedom, that nobody can be independently free. Based upon where you live, your freedom is tied to the person who is sharing the space with you. And there are things you give up to be free. I mean, I think about that Thomas Jefferson quote. Anybody who wants to be ignorant and free at the same time, you want something that's never been and never will be. You cannot be ignorant and free. So when we talk about being free, there are some things we have to give up. And ignorance is one of them. Giving up this notion that I stand alone, that's a second one. Giving up the fact that the government, under a, quote, free society, has a lot of rule and reign over us. That part of us even going through COVID-19 is giving up your freedom around body autonomy. For people who did not choose to go down the road before the mandates for the COVID-19 vaccine, that's something you've given up in a so-called free society. It also means we can't mandate how people treat each other. It means we can't mandate a change in the hearts and minds of people. It means we cannot love our way out of racism and white supremacy. I don't think love is enough. I don't. I don't think laws are enough. I don't think policies, practices, and procedures are enough to change the hearts and minds of people. It's going to take a lot more than that. Because if that was the case, and talking about a free society and the work of Fannie Lou Hamer, if it was just about struggling, I would argue that black and brown folks have struggled enough in this country. I would argue the LGBTQIA community has struggled enough. The Asian American community has struggled enough. The disabled community has struggled enough in this society. So there should be equality across the board. So we know struggling is not enough. I don't think it's about litigation. All those groups I just mentioned, in terms of laws, going to court, having the lawyers, pushing up against the justice system, taking it all the way to the Supreme Court, changing the laws, that even that's not enough. I don't think it's about having acts come from the executive branch. We got the Voting Rights Act of 65, Civil Rights Act of 64, Fair Housing Act of 1968, and we still don't have equity or equality in voting when it comes to our rights or in housing practices. So it's not about acts coming from the executive branch. We know it's not about laws being changed coming from the legislative branch. That's not enough. It's against the law to discriminate against people. It is actually against the law to do so. But we know just having a law on the books, that's not enough. It does not change what I would argue is the final frontier. There is a battleground that we are still fighting against, and we try to push against that every day on this show. We are fighting against the hearts and the minds of people. People who believe that we are not enough, who believe that we don't belong at the table, who believe that things should go back to how they used to be, who believe that they have the right to rule just because, who believe that blacks should not be in positions of power, who shouldn't be at the table, shouldn't be in the room. We're trying to change their hearts and their minds. And from where I sit and the work I'm seeing and taking a look at the landscape as I sit here in Baltimore, which we call, you know, the top of the South and the bottom of the North, we see that the work we have started, that our ancestors started, the work we're trying to push forward, we're trying to continue to carry the ball down the line to get closer to wherever you can get the touchdown, closer to the goal for the next generation, we still have a long way to go. Fannie Lou Hamer said that she was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Because at this moment, as we understand it, it is going to be hard for us to move forward in this current iteration of what America looks like. It's going to be hard unless people are willing to give up what they've been holding on to. You got to be able to give up the racism. You got to be able to give up the white supremacy. You got to be able to give up the classism. You got to give up the homophobia. You got to give up the sexism. You got to be able to give it up. Shake it off. Drop whatever it is that's holding you back. Didn't Toni Morrison say, hey, if you want to fly, you got to give up the stuff. And she didn't say stuff. She said the other S word. You got to give up the stuff that's holding you down. If you truly want to fly, you got to give it up. If we want to fly and soar as a society, we got to be willing. Everybody collectively has to be willing to give it up. So let's take a listen to Fannie Lou Hamer and her own.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roosevelt, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Roosevelt. And Reverend Jeff Sonny carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children that told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down, tried to register. After they told me, my husband came and said the plantation owner was raising Cain because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I mean that, said, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave. Said, then if you go down and withdraw, that you still might have to go because we are not ready for that in Mississippi. And I addressed him and told him that I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself. I had to leave that same night. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
Thank you. That was Fannie Lou Hamer. Just speaking her truth. Fannie Lou Hamer, who was run down and beat down by the pressure of fighting against racism and sexism and trying to change the political direction in this country. If you want to fly, says Toni Morrison, and you got to give up whatever is holding you back, what's holding you down, what's stopping you from moving forward. I want to get into that conversation today because I want to talk with you about the syndemic and how we are doing and what we need to do in terms of moving forward. I was thinking today about this notion of the syndemic, and we talked about this early on during the time of COVID-19, but I want to take you back to this notion of a syndemic. A syndemic is what happens when you have multiple sets of closely interrelated endemic and epidemic conditions. And we're saying multiple sets because a set is that you have a lot of different things kind of pulled together as one, and then all of them come at you. So within the Black community, some of the issues that we're dealing with, things that are ravaging our economically challenged Black brothers and sisters, is that we are dealing with HIV, tuberculosis, STDs, hepatitis, cirrhosis, infant mortality, drug abuse, suicide, homicide, poverty, COVID-19, the miseducation that happens to our children, among other issues that we are facing. When we talk about a syndemic, and that term was put forth by Meryl Singer back in 1994, and in 1992, so the early 1990s, he was talking about this. He was trying to look at a longstanding observation that communities most impacted by new epidemics often are already facing other epidemics. So we're already facing other threats, and then you add on a new epidemic. We're already dealing with the things I mentioned, and then you add COVID-19 on top of that. The crucial point was that these conditions did not merely co-occur. The synergy among epidemics made each one of the issues, each set was made worse because of the synergy among the epidemics, the connective tissue among the epidemics. So syndemic theory then says that you have disease concentration and disease interaction. So disease concentration refers to the co-occurrence or clustering of multiple epidemics as a result of a large-scale or political economic forces and adverse social conditions. Disease interaction is about the way that these epidemics overlap and exacerbate the health effects of these adverse social conditions. Okay, so what exactly does that mean? That means if you are already dealing with underlying health conditions, you're already living in community where you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, you're already dealing with low employment numbers, you're already dealing with obesity rates, you're already dealing with, you know, those underlying conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, you're already dealing with that, and you couple that with the lack of access to fresh, clean drinking water, a lack of access to fresh, clean air to breathe. Let's be clear, environmental injustice is real. If you add COVID-19 on top of that, then what you've done is you've taken one epidemic and you've layered it over multiple sets of other epidemics, which are all these adverse social conditions. These moments that we are having, where we talk about each one of these sets of epidemics, these biological interactions, these biosocial interactions, we're starting to realize that for some communities, the impact of COVID-19 will be felt for a long time. It's not just that we're losing loved ones, and my heart, of course, goes out to everyone who lost someone during COVID-19. It's about the rate of recovery from COVID-19. Based upon this data, the rate of recovery for Black folks coming out of COVID-19 will take a much longer time than our white or our Asian American counterparts because of disease concentration and disease interaction. We are in for a much longer road because the inequities that have shaped the distributions of risk and resources for health result in the social and spatial clustering of epidemic diseases. So what does that mean? It means we were already struggling. We were already suffering. We were already behind. We were already fighting for air. We were already fighting for water. We were already fighting for education. We were already fighting for adequate health care. We were already fighting for adequate housing. We were already fighting for these things. COVID-19 laid bare that as far back as we thought we were, we are much farther back at this moment. These inequities, this epidemic diseases, the disease concentration means that we're now trying to figure out how to climb out of a hole that's been shaped by social, economic, and power inequities. All of these inequities already shape the poor health that we have. Why is it that Black men struggle with prostate cancer more than any other ethnic group in this country? Why is it that Black women struggle with breast cancer more than any other group in this country? Why is it that more Black women die during childbirth in 2021 more than any other ethnic group in this country? Why? Because we're dealing with disease concentration coming into contact with disease interaction, and we are living under a syndemic as a result of it. We should be talking about the urgency of this moment. I think about Dr. King, who did a speech called The Fierce Urgency of Now. And in that speech, Dr. King was talking about what it means to wrestle with racism. And what does it mean for this country to finally do the work that it has to do to bring things back into some type of order? Dr. King, when he talked about the fierce urgency of now, set us up to understand that this reflection that he laid out before us was calling us to do more and to be more. He gave this speech in 1963, you know, at the Lincoln Memorial, Washington, D.C., on the National Mall. Dr. King said, the fierce urgency of now. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to give you the quote from Dr. King, and I want to talk to you about whether or not you think the Black folks are facing a fierce urgency of now. Stay with us after the break. Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Dr. King said, we are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is now. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. This is no time for apathy or complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action. The fierce urgency of now. It's not just a call to action, it's also a call to acknowledge truth. But let's be clear, folks. I think we can all agree there is no justice without truth. Like, we're not talking about, you know, hyperbole. We're saying if we want to have justice in this country, justice must be tied to the truth. If we want to talk about white supremacy and institutional racism, and the way they have caused our communities to suffer, the way they have crippled what Dr. King called the spiritual vitality of our nation, then we have to wrestle with both truth and justice. Is America ready to tell the truth about the history of this country? Are we ready to accept the truth about the history of this country? What does the fierce urgency of now mean to you? 410-319-8888. Call and answer this question. You could put something else on the table for the weekly wrap. The question I've laid out before you as we celebrate Fannie Lou Hamer's birthday is from Dr. King's speech, where he called and pointed out that this is a moment right here for the fierce urgency of now, that we can no longer be patient with this country for the change that needs to happen to bring about justice and to wrestle with the truth, that we are beyond waiting. We are beyond being patient. We are beyond trying to work it out. We are beyond having to brainstorm our own solutions. The fierce urgency of now that Dr. King mentioned in 1963, we are at that moment. Now, King, if he were here, would argue, well, we were at that moment in 1963. I think that moment came and it went. I do. I think there was a fierce urgency of now in 63. And I think we were beat down with the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church and when they assassinated Kennedy and assassinated King and assassinated X and assassinated Medgar Evers. I think they just beat us down step by step. Bombing churches, blowing up children, they beat us down. Arresting our leaders, they beat us down. Assassinating our leaders, they beat us down. Women were arrested. They were beaten. Some of them, they had illegal medical procedures performed on them. I'm thinking about Fannie Lou Hamer, where they weren't able to have children. They beat us down. They sick the dogs on us, the water hoses, put us underneath the jail. Sometimes they put us in farm pig pens to hold us overnight. They beat us down. Shooting and killing our unarmed brothers and sisters, our unarmed sons and daughters. Trayvon Martin, Tamia Rice, Corinne Gaines in her own home, Breonna Taylor in her own home. They beat us down. And along the way, victories were had. I mean, thinking about the election of Barack Obama, the election of Kamala Harris, the ways in which Colin Powell, you know, ascended to power. But on the way, as they gave us these apples, they also kept beating us with a stick pushing us forward. They beat us down. This society, I believe, has made us tired. And I think in our fatigue, we have become a bit complacent. We are not acting as if we are under a moment where the fierce urgency of now is real. That we are in the midst of a crisis of truth, a racial crisis, a crisis of violence, and a crisis of safety. Dr. King said these four crises that we're dealing with should be pushing us forward to fundamentally transform our society. How do we have truth without justice? How do we deal with the racial issue without dismantling white supremacy? How do we deal with violence without asking ourselves how we can lean in to protect our children? And how do we deal with safety without being willing to do whatever we can to make sure that our communities are kept safe from predators, from those who wish to do us harm, that our children will be safe going back and forth to school, from those who don't care about whether they make it home at night? That fierce urgency of now that Dr. King was talking about is one that should move us forward. Are we in a pandemic? Do you think that what we're dealing with right now is this long pandemic where we have multiple issues that are coming at us at one time? And if that is the case, then how do we get out of it? Is there a way for Black folks, for Brown folks, as in Latinx folks, for indigenous folks to ever get from underneath the boot that seeks to crush our neck? I don't know. Jill Scott is talking about this. Jill Scott, the singer, the Grammy Award-winning artist and actress, recently said that it's terrifying to raise a son in America. She's now saying that she's looking at moving so she can protect her 12-year-old son. This is her quote here. It's terrifying because it doesn't matter if you have or you don't. All that matters is that you're brown. That's it. Now, Jill Scott shares the sentiments of so many other black parents in this country, including First Lady Michelle Obama, who once said that she worries every time her daughters get into the car by themselves. I worry about what assumption is being made by somebody who doesn't know everything about them. So Jill Scott said the best place for black folks to move, which she feels is the safest place, is Holland. She said, we like Holland. They're chilling. They have great health care. They ride their bikes everywhere. People are pretty fit. They speak more than Dutch. Most people speak 3 or 4 languages. It's dope. It's below sea level, so the food is well hydrated. She said she loves the education system in Holland. So she is looking at moving her 12-year-old son to Holland so she can keep him safe. The issues that we're talking about of where we have to go, I think it's easy to approach this conversation about seriously moving if you have the resources to do it. How about those of us who do not? Well, we're dealing with these pandemics and we don't have the resources to move. The Atlantic ran a story about the demographic distinctiveness of COVID-19 mortality. This is in the American South. And they said young people were dying there at harder and higher rates than in other hard-hit regions because of the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. The suspected pathway was a higher burden of those chronic diseases that I mentioned earlier, the hypertension, the diabetes, the socio-political economic factors such as poverty, limited government investment in health care, social and political economic factors such as dealing with mass incarceration that comes along with that, health care issues, hypertension, diabetes, all of that puts us squarely in the middle of this pandemic. And if you add on top of all those things I mentioned, all of the ways in which you're dealing with the biosocial changes that impact society, we cannot discount that one of the main issues that is affecting the health of black people in this country is dealing with white supremacy. There is a lot of research to show what happens when black people come into contact with white people and how it affects us when we're dealing with racism, that it actually takes years off of our life. Like, you know, you might think it's nothing just to see a burning cross or to hear someone threaten only black people or to watch the videos of black people dying on screen. Yes, it affects us. It takes years off of our lives. And so we had to take a look and do a test to figure out about the rates of hypertension and high blood pressure and diabetes. But once the results came in, it was clear that when you are struggling with those issues, your road up is much higher. Holly Robinson Pete, to stay on that same vein of what does it mean to be free? Where can black folks go for freedom? Jill Scott says she's getting out, going to Holland. The word is that Beyonce's raising her children in Paris, over somewhere on the coast somewhere in France. We know Tina Turner lives over in France. I believe that Ta-Nehisi Coates had his family in France. Folks are getting out of the country. Folks who can. Here's the reason why. Holly Robinson Pete, the actress, slammed Air Canada after her son was barred from the plane. So she said that what ended up happening, which is interesting. And this is her quote here to Air Canada. It was a tweet. Excuse me, Air Canada, but you've got some explaining to do. My sons have just been refused to get on the airplane and travel because they couldn't produce our credit card that paid for the tickets. One of them is a minor, and they are now stranded in the airport. She said that she has been traveling back and forth to Canada on the airline for 35 years. They never asked her to swipe the credit card or even produce the credit card used so they can get on the plane. I was so fascinated by this story because who is it that flies, and you have to produce the credit card that you use to purchase the ticket. I know that I've had to show my passport. I know that I've had to show my driver's license. I know that I've had to show my ticket, my boarding ticket. Sometimes I'm traveling abroad, they want to know where you're staying and how much money you're bringing in there with you. But this idea of having to show the actual credit card, to me, it is connected somehow to race. Okay. Now, some folks disagree and tell me that I'm always making it about race. Her two black sons could not get on a plane unless they produced a credit card that was used to buy the ticket. They didn't have the credit card, so they were thrown out. I'm sorry, that sounds like something racial to me. Particularly when you look at the age of the men who were trying to get on board. One of them was a minor, but the other one, I believe, was like 23 years old. These were not children. Not like five, not like seven. No, it was a teenager and a 23-year-old man trying to board a flight. Melissa Brusino on Facebook Live says, look, my son went to boarding school. And him flying alone was one of the most nerve-wracking things. He never produced a credit card. My son coming up from Memphis, Tennessee, I buy the ticket, go pick, you know, get the ticket on your phone, keep it moving. He's never had to produce the credit card. I have a feeling, folks, hear me, that we're getting ready to move back to a moment where we're going to start seeing multiple racialized incidences every single weekend and every single week. I say that because we were at this place before. We were having these weekends. People would go off and they would travel. They're dealing with COVID. And then we would hear these stories, only a sprinkle of the stories. Now we have an even bigger footprint that we're trying to make when we're talking about this evidence that is being gathered. That no matter what space we occupy, it's going to be difficult. There was a woman in Virginia, just to keep along that vein here, until you join the conversation, I want to hear from you about what you think about all these racial incidences that are happening, that if we're starting to go back into a time where they're going to continue to go up. A black woman in Virginia, this one here, got me going. Okay, so it's three on the table, right? You got Jill Scott saying, look, I'm moving to Holland. You got Holly Robinson Pete saying, look, Air Canada, my son, they had to produce the credit card, couldn't get on the flight, end up staying overnight. Tiffany Cross got involved. Hey, sis, how can we help you? Folks are saying maybe we've reached a tipping point. Maybe what COVID-19 showed us, that we're going to have a hard time trying to live together after this. Sharon Randolph said, if I had the money, I would finish raising my 16-year-old twins in Hawaii. It is still the U.S. However, I have researched that black people who are raised there do not deal with the racism of the mainland because slavery and black oppression is not a part of their history. However, the same people told the horrible experiences and adjustments they had to make when they moved to the mainland. She's saying going to Hawaii and not even going to the mainland, taking them off the mainland. Well, here's another clip. Here's another one. Here's another story. And I'm telling you, you may have to pull over for this one. What I'm going to do first, let me have you listen to this clip about Virginia. And then on the back end, I'll explain to you what's happening. Take a listen.
Whenever we would step out of our house, the monkey noises would start so, and it's disgusting. Like, I don't even know how else to explain it.
Janique Martinez recorded those sounds coming from her neighbor's house with her cell phone. She says it shows her Salem Lakes neighbor using speakers to play monkey noises when her family's outside.
It's just him. He finds a way to antagonize people and does it so passively aggressively.
She says it's not just her family getting the not so silent treatment.
He has played music to taunt the entire cul-de-sac.
But recently, Martinez says it's escalated.
He found out that we called the police on him to turn down the music one morning, and it's just been nonstop with the N-word. My son is terrified of him. Terrified. The minute I open my front door, his lights blink or my music or my song comes on. As soon as they get to the middle of their driveway, it blinks. They got a specific song.
Martinez and her neighbors were fed up with the lights and cameras. They decided to take action.
I've gone to the magistrate. I've gone to civil court. I've talked to a lawyer. I've done everything in my possession. Like, I've done what I can to do it the right way.
Ten on Your Side tried to speak with the neighbor for ourselves, but no one answered. As for a solution, neighbors were told there's a fine line of when police can actually step in, and having a racial slur played over a recording may not meet that line.
According to the law, it's just a statement or a phrase, or he's not doing enough, or, you know, bodily harm or threats to my family. I spent 11 years in the military. My husband is also a vet. We fought for this country, but yet there's no one to fight for us.
So that story is in Virginia. Okay, hear this out. Okay. This woman in Virginia, a black woman in Virginia, says that her neighbor plays monkey noises and racial slurs over speakers to taunt her family. Y'all, I mean, at some point, people won't be throwing hands up in here, because I don't understand how every time sister girl walks out the house, every time her son walks out the house, the neighbor has set up, this would drive me insane. So now I know I have neighbors who listen to this show. Look, y'all, we're not even going down this road, okay? We're not. Because this is the kind of stuff that moving doesn't solve the problem. Why? I may not be able to afford to move. I just bought this house. I saved up for this house. I got money poured into this house. This house is dragging me down. I can't get rid of this house. And why should I have to move? Her neighbor, which he must not be a black man, because I don't know any black man that would set this up in the way this guy has done. Every time she steps out, now I don't know if he has set up something, it's comes like a system here. Like, it's multiple home cameras and blinking lights. You got cameras facing my house? Okay, so that's problem number one. Steps out the house. What begins to play over speakers? Brother man has put speakers up outside of his windows. And every time she moves, monkey noises start to play. Racial slurs start to play every time she moves. He's actually, when she called the police on him, because, you know, unfortunately, y'all, sometimes we're rule followers, right? Got a problem with my neighbor. I'm going to call the police because it's getting really bad. And she did. She called the police, alerted them about the noise, said, hey, it's getting where it's very disturbing. It is harassment at this point. He is harassing me. And he has been doing it, listen to this, for more than a year. For a year, every time you walk out the house, a speaker starts where you hear the N-word being blurted out at you. You're hearing monkey noises every time you walk out the house. For a year, she's very patient. Let me just say, she's very patient. Because, you know, I would have... My line might have been crossed. Now, I consider myself to be a very patient person. I ain't that patient. I'm just going to say that. And I'm specifically using the ain't word. I ain't that patient. Every time I walk out, every time my son walks out, monkey noises play. Every time I go get some groceries, I hear the N-word being shouted out. Every time I pull up in my car, you know, I got my Jill Scott blaring. I turn off my Whitney Houston. I step out my car and boom, the noises start every single time. She said it's actually been escalating because it started off, got the monkey noises going on. And then he put some music on there. And then after she reported him to the police, he added audio of racial epithets. So I listen to it, and it's the N-word. It's like old news reports where they're using the N-word. I don't even know what station he pulled this from, but you could tell that they're old news reports. She says her son is terrified of him, with an exclamation point. Terrified. The police department, in doing their job, says, look, this is appalling. This is offensive. This is according to the police, quote, unpleasant. It's all of that. But let me tell you what it's not, according to the cops. According to the cops, it's not a crime. I don't even understand this. It's not a crime. And they said they can't do anything. They cannot do anything to stop this neighbor from playing monkey noises and audio of the N-word every time she walks out. It's like people have just lost their mind during COVID, y'all. I want you to understand this. A year ago, we were all locked in for COVID. So you're talking, you're locked in. So when she opens her door, the noises start. The city attorney in Virginia have determined that the actions reported do not rise to the level that's defined in Virginia as criminal behavior. You know, so she says here, she is exasperated. She's tried to find solutions within the criminal and civil courts. The system's not protecting her family. I don't know what to do. I've spent 11 years in the military. My husband is also a vet. Okay, you know what? Shut the front door. Her husband lives there too. So dad is also listening to this. I don't know, y'all. For a minute there, I thought it was just her and the little boy. No. Husband's up in the house. Now, let me just say, I know my husband. Okay, I do. I know my husband. My husband's a good man. He is. My husband's a patient man because he's a principal. He is. But ain't no way my husband's going to put up for a year. Every time we roll up to the house, every time we step out the door, every time we go get the paper, every time we take out the trash, every time you're going to play monkey noise, you have cameras facing our house, spotlights. So just they're motion sensitive. So when I move, it starts to play. Are you kidding me? We have Wesley on the phone from Reisterstown. Wesley, how are you?
Old. Why do you say it's not a black person, though? I don't understand.
I just think it's interesting because typically in stories like this, they've given race all along. They don't give the race of the neighbor.
Okay.
And in Communication 101, we know when they don't give the race, they typically only keep the race when the race is white.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, could be she's living next door to Larry Elder. Could be Tim Scott. Could be Clarence Thomas.
Could
be,
oh my word.
Could be a whole lot of Negroes out there doing that.
That's
what I mean?
True. Because I mean, you know, actually, brother? Actually, you're right. There are a couple of people who should not be invited to the picnic
and
the cookout.
And they should not be allowed to bring no potato salad with raisins.
Not at all. Potato salad with raisins. So I'm saying, so let me ask you, Wesley, what would you do?
I'm going over there. I've had a situation like that. Not quite like that, but, you know, I had a situation when I was living in Carroll County, and that's a different thing, but, I mean, I just knocked on a person's door and did what I had to do. Now, it could have gone bad for me. I understand that, too, but you have to understand, you have to weigh the situation there. Had they been doing something to me, I give them a little bit of a pass, but when they start on my kids and my wife...
Terrorizing your wife and your child, your son?
They don't get no pass. They don't get no pass. But I just want to say this, and I'll leave you alone. Don't forget, Larry Elder, Tim Scott, Clarence Thomas, and people of that ilk are just as much of a white supremacist and supporter as the Ku Klux Klan is. So I just want to get that off my chest.
Come on. Thank you so much. I'm sorry. You're terrorizing my wife. You're terrorizing my son. Let me just clear this up. Someone's like, oh, you know, that sounds really sexist. I'm sorry. If there's a man next door who is terrorizing my family like this, I'm being very honest. I probably wouldn't go over there. My son probably wouldn't go over there. But my husband would. A year? You got spotlights? Motion sensitive, motion action directed towards my house, monkey noise. I don't want my son to have spent a year being terrorized. What lesson is that giving my son? That we can be treated any old kind of way and nobody can do anything about it. We have Glord on the phone. Glord from Glen Oak. How are you? Glord, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Dr. K. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, I hear you very well. A while back, I did call your radio station. I think you probably was something up similar to this. And I told you that I lived in Baltimore. I've been here all my life.
Yes.
And you was wanting to know what your sons should do to defend themselves. You know, I had mentioned them, go take karate, because I took karate. You know, people take boxing and everything. Unfortunate, you know, that people cannot leave. Some people can leave. Okay, and that's fine. The ones that can't leave, and we had to deal with the situation. It was unfortunate. And when she reported it to the police department, and the police can't help you, so we already know what we're dealing with, you know, from day to day. So it's unfortunate some people, can, you know, would attack, deal with these situations, and some don't. So I've been blessed all my years, you know, living in the United States, living around those areas, because where I come from, I dealt with all kinds of folks, and you have to deal with them. But luckily, I didn't have to do nothing violent. But it's around us. People go off, they spin on people all the time. And with this young lady and her husband there, maybe he's not a fighter, or he didn't want to address it for a whole year. But the thing is, if I was living in that area, and I know she got some brothers, or because the Bloods and the Crips, they really supposed to be in our community to protect us, okay. And that's what I would do. I would just have a couple of brothers come in and live in my house, free room and board, okay. and we deal with this situation.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lord. I'm not sure if I'm bringing up anybody else in my house, because I'm saying, so when the Blood and Crips leave, then what, the music starts again, the monkey noises? Do we have time for one more phone call? All right, let's get one more here. Let's get Charles from Baltimore before the break. Charles, how are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. How you doing, Dr. K?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Is this a next-door neighbor?
Yes.
Okay. Simple solution. Go out and buy yourself about 6 5-gallon gasoline cans.
Uh-oh.
And paint KKK on them. And line them up right at the fence line.
Okay.
you don't have to put no gas in them, because he's going to call the cops. But there'll be empty gas cans. But then he'll know that they're not playing with his butt.
All right. Thank you so much, Charles. Folks, we're going to hold it here. We're going to put a pin here. And we're going to have an opportunity to speak to Dean Emeritus Dwayne Wickham about Haiti. And then we come back in the 3:30 p.m. block. We're going to pick this conversation up again. Stay with us today with Dr. K talking about Haiti when we return.